The following program is underwritten by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. Welcome to Humanities Connection, a production of WFDU-FM and the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. I'm Bob Mann. This is a special episode of Humanities Connection. Normally, our format calls for two segments, each with a separate guest and topic. But today, we have one guest for the entire half hour. But the scope will be much broader, and that's because our guest is the new executive director of the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, Karin Berkowitz. Karin, congratulations on the new job, and welcome to the council and to WFDU.
Thanks so much, Bob. I'm really excited to be here.
You're excited about the job. Obviously, this is something you wanted, but let's be frank, this is a tough time for the humanities and for the arts in the United States in our current political climate. Talk a little bit about some of the challenges the humanities face.
Absolutely. So I like to think that the flip side of any challenge is an opportunity. It is a challenging time for the humanities, partly, I think, because on the one hand, in education, we're so focused on STEM these days. We're so focused on science, technology, engineering, medicine. And we don't see that actually there's a humanities and an arts component to those things that's fundamentally important. And then on the other side, on the more sort of popular side, I feel as though there has not been a time in my lifetime, at least, when people have been less open to dialogue among those of opposing views. And so that's where I think some of the challenge and the opportunity for the humanities lies, is in helping to bridge some of those divides and also helping to point out how there's a history and a humanities component to everything.
We've dealt with this a number of times. We've been doing the show since March of 2010, and it's been very exciting and stimulating for those of us who are working on it. But very often people get confused between the humanities and the arts. It's related. They are related. But what specifically does the term humanities mean as contrasted to the arts?
That's a great question. And those of us who work in a humanities environment, I think even sometimes struggle to make that word relatable. The humanities historically have been a set of disciplines within the academy. So think English literature, think history, think philosophy. When I talk about the humanities, though, what I say to people is that the humanities are the things that help us understand other people's perspectives. So literature helps us get inside of other people's thoughts. History helps us know how we got to where we are, in part through the actions of those who came before us, right? Philosophy helps us think about how people put together thoughts more broadly. And so the arts have a very creative dimension. I think the humanities have a kind of analytical dimension that allows us to think about the world from a perspective that's not our own personal perspective.
I've also heard a good definition which says that the humanities discuss every aspect of what it is to be human.
That's right. I think that's right. The core of the word is human, right? And the humanities absolutely get at that core.
But there are relationships and similarities to the arts. For example, I've had many playwrights and directors on the program who have been funded by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. And what ends up happening is that they do a play, but it's about a social issue. Yeah. So the play is really an art. It's one of the arts. But it's the subject matter that's the humanities. And then very often NJCH will come in and have all kinds of other programs which support that. Let's talk, though, a little bit about you as a new executive director. And your predecessor had been there for 5 years, so you're coming in,
That's right. You
know, after someone had been there for quite some time. Tell us about your main interest, which academically, your primary interest, the history of science and the history of medicine.
Yes. So history of science is kind of this funny boutique in-between discipline. And it goes back to what I said earlier about everything having a humanities component. Well, people in history of science look at the human side of science. They look at how it's unfolded historically, who took part in it, what were the contingencies that helped to shape these things that we regard as truths now. Because those truths came to be in a context, right? So it's it provides that kind of context. And I think actually it's a really good demonstration of the power of the humanities to understand the world, because you can't understand modern science. You can't understand its authority in the modern world. You can't understand how it came to be what it is today without looking at where it came from.
And also, even in the scientific community, some of the greatest scientists going back 100, 200 years ago had misconceptions. They were working with inaccurate information, and science has evolved. While science is about facts and things that can be demonstrated very clearly and distinctly, there have still been theories which have been disproven, or people were operating on a false premise.
That's right. And I always tell, when I teach undergraduate students, I always tell them that we think we know what truths are today, right? But 200 years from now, someone will reflect historically on our truths and they'll say, can you believe people thought that? So people always have a reason for thinking what they do at the time, and they always have evidence. But evidence can be used in different ways to support different truths. You get new evidence in, and suddenly it changes what you think you know about the world around you. So these things are always shifting. And one of the really interesting things for a historian of science is to see that scientists used to think in exactly this way. So in the 19th century, scientific treatises begin with a kind of a history of the field or the discipline within which the scientist is working.
Yeah, they're giving you some perspective as to where they get started and what they're standing on as a foundation.
That's right.
Now, you were mentioning, Karin, that you teach and have taught undergraduates. But you also once did a science lecture during happy hour in a karaoke bar. What exactly was the situation going on there?
I did. There's a program in Philadelphia called Science on Tap that brings science or history of science lectures to, as you say, a karaoke bar. The lecture I gave was about the interrelationship between science, religion, and the arts historically in the 19th century. And it was great. I got some of the best questions I've ever received from a group of people standing around drinking a beer while I was chatting, which made it an awful lot of fun.
Well, people, usually not in an academic context, are discussing those subjects while having a couple of beers.
Of course. I don't know anyone who goes for a beer without talking about the interrelationship between science, religion, and the arts.
But basically, science has to be for the public, and there are many people who are doing this, like Neil deGrasse Tyson. It has to be much more relatable in terms of people really understanding it, and especially now because, let's face it, we're dealing with a lot of science denial in our society today.
That's true. So one of the things that I think people within history of science as well as within science itself are grappling with is thinking about how do we make clear the expertise that supports the knowledge that we have, right? So when somebody says vaccines work, It's not based on a theory. It's not based on a premise. It's not even based on scanty evidence. It's based on the expertise that comes with a lifetime of experience, that comes with a long history of experience, even, you know, beyond that person, and with the consensus of a community of scientists. But we see today that there's a lot of distrust around expertise, around these expert communities that develop consensus. And so that's something that, as a society, I think we're wrestling with. And it's not unprecedented, but it does create problems. Because if you don't believe that certain people have the weight of education and history and a whole community such that they can speak truths, then sort of everything's up for grabs, right? And it becomes a lot harder to tell how you should shape policy in that kind of context.
And these are matters of life and death, too. We don't need to get political and get into any specifics, but you're very often talking in terms of health and the future of the planet in terms of life and death. It's not just an opinion. It's not just a position.
That's right.
Who was Charles Bell?
Charles Bell, he's my friend. He was a
very old friend.
Very old friend. I feel like I lived with Charles Bell for about 10 years. Charles Bell was a late 18th and early 19th century surgeon and anatomist, and he was also an artist. He's the scientist who came up with theory of motor and sensory nerves that says that those two things operate in separate and parallel tracks. It's a complex theory, but it made sense of the nervous system. Bell's palsy is named after Charles Bell.
I always feel bad for physicians who research and fight a disease, and then they get the disease named after them.
That's
which is
right.
Kind of a shame. Now, the reason I brought up Charles Bell, this is not just something I pulled out of space. You wrote a book
about his
work and about his life.
That's right. That's what I mean about spending 10 years with him. He left a lovely track record of his life through letters that he wrote to his family. And unlike today, where we probably mostly delete our emails, people kept their letters during his lifetime. So we have very good evidence for what he was thinking, what he was doing. He's a really interesting figure because he was working at a time when there was a revolution going on in France, when there was a lot of political upheaval. It wasn't clear whether Britain would be able to sort of keep away from the path of revolution at that time. And he was trying to overhaul some aspects of medical education, but not in a way that seemed threatening. So in this revolutionary context, he wants to present what he's doing as a fairly safe path for reform. Makes him a really interesting character. And the fact that he was also an artist, that he was also connected to a group of philosophers and lawyers, he's got a really interesting life trajectory.
What's the title of the book, if any audience members want to check it out on the internet?
It's called Charles Bell and the Anatomy of Reform.
Very good. You're listening to Humanities Connection. This is a production of WFDU-FM and the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. I'm Bob Mann. This program is broadcast on a monthly basis on WFDU, and then it's archived at njhumanities.org. And you can also go to that site for information about anything being done by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities, and also to hear archives of this particular program. My guest is Karin Berkowitz, who's the new executive director of the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. And even though I was mentioning to the audience before, Karin, that we have been doing the show for now 9 years, but because I and my production partner don't work for the council, there are still some things I don't totally understand, even though we bring the guests on and talk about their topics. For example, the difference between an action grant and an incubation grant. What are the differences between those two, and how would that affect the grantees and also the public who would benefit from it?
Oh, thanks for that question, Bob. That's actually one of the strengths, I think, of how we award grants at NJCH. We have this set of grants called incubation grants that are really made for people who have a rough idea of what it is they want to do, but they don't have their action plan yet. They're still kind of trying to figure out maybe who their audience is, or maybe how they bring their audience in and get them involved in the project, because most of our projects are very community-based. As public history projects, we really depend on those projects to reach a public. So people are still working through some aspect of their project. And they can apply for those incubation grants and get a little seed money to help with a stage that most grant makers don't support, which is that sort of early, I need to pilot something, I need to do an audience study, I need to figure out what my community needs, kind of stage of putting a project together.
They almost find their audience. They may
That's
have
right.
the idea, you really like the idea, but they haven't found their audience
That's
yet.
That's exactly right. So we think that we offer a really good and unique opportunity there to support those early stage works. And our head of programs, Gigi Naglek, does a wonderful job of helping to sort of coach people through that grant application process and helping them make the most out of the resources that we give them, even once the grant has been made. And our action grants, on the other hand, go to projects that are really ready to launch. So you know who your audience is, you know what you want to do, you need some money to actually make it happen. And that's where our action grants come in. So they're bigger grants, and they're grants for a later stage in development. We do see some projects make their way from incubation to action grant as the grant-based project becomes sort of more whole.
We live with this program in two worlds. One is to try to be as contemporary as possible, and we're doing this in January of 2019. This could be rerun in the summer, and for sure it will be archived at njhumanities.org. So as we talk about this, I'm looking forward to the new year worth of programs that we're going to be doing. Yeah. A lot of those are action grants, some are incubation grants, but they're in many cases much more developed and down the line by the time they get to the radio show. You're still working at every single phase when you're talking about what you're doing down in Trenton at New Jersey Council for the Humanities. So give us an idea of some of the things that the council is working on right now that interest you the most, whether it's something that's either coming to an end or an action grant that's right in the middle or something that's really in the incubation stage. Let's go through some of those.
Sure. So we have, for example, an open incubation grant with the Lost Souls Public Memorial Project coming out of East Brunswick. That, to me, is a really exciting project. I was at an event that they held in December, and they're really doing a great job of bringing their community in. The Unitarian Society found, along with some partners, that one of the street signs in the town of East Brunswick carries the name of a New Jersey judge from the early 19th century. And as they did some digging, they found that that judge was involved in selling what they thought were approximately 100 black men, women, and children into slavery in the Deep South. And it turns out it's actually pushing closer to 200 at this point as they do their historical detective work. And they realized that they really needed to create a public memorial so that the information that they had found wasn't lost to history again.
How about getting that guy's name off the street sign? Was that step one?
I think that's something they're still working on with the town council. But they are definitely raising public awareness, and that's been an amazing project. It was standing room only in December when they brought people out to have a day of remembrance. It was really great to see how many people are really invested in trying to build community through understanding a shared history, even when it's a complicated history.
Doing this show, Karin, has really been great for me because of the fact that I find out about things that I could never have imagined or thought of. And this Lost Souls Project fits right in there because this sounds like the plot line to 12 Years a Slave, but there, you know, he was abducted. This is a case where a judge actually used legal manipulation or exploitation or threat to send free northern blacks into the South, into slavery.
That's right. So slaves at this point were fetching a great deal of money. Slavery was a dying institution. And so this New Jersey judge used his authority, his power as a judge, to coerce mothers into signing papers because they thought that otherwise they would lose their children, to convince people who were illiterate to sign something that they didn't know what it was. It's a kind of a tragic.
Sounds evil on a lot of different levels.
It is. And I think even at the time, so a lot of times we talk about history and we say, well, at the time things would have been regarded differently. This is something that would not have been regarded differently at the time. We know from newspaper articles that people in Philadelphia, people in New Jersey were already aware that there were predators in the community who were preying on the black community of the area. So
there were people in the white community who didn't want this, saw that this was happening and were trying to do something to stop it at the time.
That's right.
But
that's
not always successful.
Yeah, that's right. So it's a wonderful thing to be able to make these things more sort of openly available. I think it's something that most people didn't know anything about in the area, to remind us all that people's decisions are fraught historically, that sometimes people do really bad things, right? And also, you know, we're from an area that we think of as unproblematic, mm-hmm. And every area in the United States has a problematic history with respect to race. So,
and really, you know, no matter how tough these subjects are, We have to face them, we have to talk about them, and it has to be out there. And I personally think we're a lot better for it.
That's
as American society.
Right.
Let's talk about, quickly, we only have about 10 minutes left in the program, but some of the other programs that NJCH is working on that are particularly interesting and exciting to you.
Sure. So I think you're going to highlight this project a little bit later in the year, but we have a grant open with the Camden County College on a project around 1968. I think this is one that really shows the value of the humanities, that really shows the value of history, because we just went through the 50th anniversary of 1968. And for young people who might be listening, I don't know if you know how important that year was, but as we try to understand...
You're being so nice to assume that I wasn't alive and conscious in 1968. Thank you so very much. We could wrap up the show right then and there, and I'd be happy. I will tell you a story in just a couple of minutes to tell you exactly what a life changer it was for me, because it was my freshman year in high school.
Yeah, 1968 it was a very, very tumultuous year, right? And so one of the things that the humanities have the potential to do is to provide a kind of context that's reassuring to those of us who feel like everything is upheaval around us right now. So we can look backwards at 1968 and we can see that in that moment, it seemed like everything in American life was coming to a head. There was the potential for violence everywhere. There was potential for political strife everywhere.
Domestically and internationally, all at the same time.
That's right. And I imagine that, you know, it was a time that felt incredibly threatening. And so to look back at it, both to see the roots of some of the things that we're discussing now and to see that some of the questions we address are not new, and also to remind ourselves that that feeling of tension is something that's cyclical, right? Issues are coming to the fore. People are talking about things that are really uncomfortable. It's true now. It was true 50 years ago. There may be lulls in between, but this seems to be something that periodically humanity needs to do. We need to engage with each other in ways that are uncomfortable.
I'll tell you my story in under
Please
a minute.
Please do.
Okay. So I'm 14 years old now. Here's the thing about 1968 to me. It upended everything I had been taught.
Uh-huh.
It was everything you were taught is right, may not necessarily be, or it's in a different context. So I'm in a Catholic prep school, and one of our alums is on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he comes, and the headmaster is thrilled about this whole thing. And this is all a bunch of testosterone-driven boys, all boys prep school. Yeah, and he's, you know, talking about how important the Vietnam War is. And all of the young faculty, many of them priests, got up and walked out on him. The headmaster was livid as well. You know, he was embarrassed by the whole thing. And I was literally there, and, you know, I'm clapping and cheering. I mean, I'm still a loyal American. It doesn't mean that it questions my American loyalty, but we're just starting to find out about what was wrong with Vietnam. And see these teachers walk out. That's an authority figure. That's
right.
Not just some kid who made a decision to be a rebel. That's when I knew the world changed. Right that second,
right.
And it was very personal.
Right, right. Absolutely. There were people on both sides in all communities, people who were authority figures as well as, you know, sort of young rebels. We see that actually in one of the programs that's coming out of this grant on 1968 that's being done in Camden County. They're revisiting the arrests and the trials of people who broke into the draft office and burned and destroyed draft cards in Camden. And that group notoriously included some priests.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, just like you're saying, it was authority figures as well who were standing up and saying this is wrong, as well as people saying, no, no, this is what we need to be doing.
And then you're home in the summer and you turn on the TV, and I grew up with television, but you didn't realize what its power it was until everybody started to scream in the streets of Chicago, the whole world is watching, the whole world is watching. And it's like, yeah, so now if something goes awry, the whole world is watching. I mean, I can't wait to do actually this segment because of the fact that as we record in January, it's next month's show.
Yeah.
So that's exciting. A couple of other quick things because we only have about 5 minutes, so we can just talk briefly about each of those.
Sure. So I'm really excited, too, about some films that are coming from the Buongiorno team right now. The program is called Rust. It's a part of a series of three films about Newark, one called Revolution, one called The Rule, and one called Rust. They're looking at the evolution of Newark as a modern American city, so going through the 1967 riots, looking at education in the city, thinking about, in Rust, thinking about Newark as a crumbling city. I was just in Newark the other day, which is, it's an exciting place right now. There's a lot of good stuff going on culturally. It is a city that's a quintessential American city, right? So we can see the stories of America in the way that the city has evolved. So that's a really interesting set of projects that we've been supporting.
That's really interesting to me because of the fact that our very first program was with the Bongiornos. It was called Revolution 67, and I'm glad that they're still out there working.
That's great.
And doing such good work. Let's talk a little bit, just to wrap it up and bring it back to you. What are some of the things that you most want out of this job, and at least the first year that you're in it? What are some of your major goals as executive director?
Well, so I'm really invested in this idea that the humanities help us bring communities together, help us get people talking about hard issues. So looking over the next year and probably the next 3 and 5 years, I would like to see us expanding the number of communities that we reach. We're looking at, we have a program called Museum on Main Street that brings an exhibit out of the Smithsonian to New Jersey. The exhibit this time is on waterways, and it'll take place at 6 sites throughout the state. But we're hoping actually to foster good conversations about the environment from a humanities perspective, even more widely than at those 6 sites. So look for us across the state fostering conversations about the environment over the next year. That's something that we're really focused on.
I admire when people do what you did, which is to go from a series of good jobs to get another job because they like the challenge. I mean, I've had the benefit of being a tenured professor for years, freelance jobs, they come and go in broadcasting. But, to pick up your roots, because you've had some really interesting jobs in your area of the history of science, and to do this, I guess something has to be really appealing for you to make a move like that.
Yeah, I really felt strongly that I wanted to get back to communities, back to broader audiences. So most of my work before now has been, to a very great extent, with academics. And I love academic history. I love academic history of science. I care very deeply about research. But I think those things are only useful insofar as we can take them out into communities and make them accessible, help communities themselves bring their own knowledge and their perspectives back into the research world. So there should be an exchange of knowledge, an exchange of ideas, and sort of breaking down the barriers between what is sometimes called the ivory tower and the rest of the world is something that's really important to me.
We only have literally 60 seconds. I know talk show hosts always say that. Sometimes they're lying and telling you the truth. Why is it important for people to care about the humanities?
Oh, it helps us to understand who we are, but it also, more importantly, helps us to understand other people. And we will never, ever have a good conversation across hard issues if we don't understand other people.
And a frank discussion, too. And some of these subjects that are touched on, they are real. I face this as the host. They are hot-button issues, but by the end of the show, you feel better about it.
That's right. And our society depends on us having those hard conversations.
Karin, it's great to have you here in the program, and thank you very much for taking the time to drive up from Trenton. Normally, we do phoners, so you went on a very cold January day to come up here, so we really do appreciate
that. Well, it's been a pleasure, and I wouldn't have missed the opportunity to see these studios and to meet you. So thanks so much.
That's great. Karin Berkowitz is the new executive director of the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. And if you are listening to our initial broadcast, we hope that you will be listening to us on WFDU 89.1 FM because of the fact that She just went through some of the really interesting things that the New Jersey Council is doing, but we'll get into depth with 15-minute segments on each of them, talking with some of the people who are really making a difference in the state of New Jersey through the New Jersey Council for the Humanities. That's it for this episode of Humanities Connection. I'm Bob Mann. Thank you very much for listening. This program is initially broadcast on WFDU 89.1 FM, and then it's archived at www.njhumanities.org. You can go to that website not only to hear archives of our program, but to hear about all of the fascinating programs that are being run throughout the state by the New Jersey Council for the Humanities.